Dana Bourgeois, a wonderful guitar manufacturer. If you don't know Dana's work, you actually do and you don't realize it, because you know Brian Sutton, you know Doc Watson, you know recordings by Ron Block. The list goes on and on and on. Dana's been making top quality guitars for a long, long time. And, you know, on this show, I like to have luthiers and authors and pick makers and capo makers and performers. And to me, it's just an opportunity to reach out to all these great individual performers, artists, craftsmen in the bluegrass and acoustic field and talk to them, and you get to listen in. So, who's on vacation right now? What a wonderful thing to be available, hanging around. It might be a nice escape for Dana, that he doesn't have to deal with vacation. I don't know, for maybe 15, 20, 30 minutes as we start up. Wonderful guy. I would say this to you, sharpen your pencils and get something comfortable to sit in, because you're going to listen to Dana talk about guitar making at that high quality level and the love that he has for musical instruments. I'm going to click in. We're going to talk to Dana in just a second. We're going to push the buttons. Hopefully he's out there, and we're struggling with a little bit of a reception problem, but we're going to give it a shot, because that's what we do on this show. He was in a car in the rain, believe it or not. That's how dedicated people are to be on this show. So hold on one second. I'm going to find him again. I know he's there.
Hello.
Hello, Dana. How are you?
Very good.
Good. All right. I appreciate the fact that you're out there trying. I was telling everyone that you're out there in the middle of the ocean in a storm, I think is the way you described it, but you're still willing to participate.
Well, actually, I'm out on an island. I live in Maine. My shop is in Lewiston, Maine, and we have a summer house on an island called Chabig Island, which is off Portland. And there's a year-round community out here. It's about five miles long, maybe about 350 residents year-round, and maybe about 1,000 houses. So it's mostly an off-season, you know, kind of thing. My family goes back here to the late 1700s, so I guess it's where I call home.
I would think so by now.
I don't get to live here all the time, though. But anyhow, yeah.
Well, Dana,
I'm glad I could plug in with you.
I am too, and the reception is much better this time, so we won't have to worry about cutting in and out. At the top of the show, which starts at 2 o'clock here in Eastern Time, I mentioned to the listeners that if they don't know your name readily, they certainly know your work with all the people that now play Bourgeois guitars. They're wonderful instruments. On this show, I like to talk to luthiers and manufacturers and authors and performers. It just kind of rounds everything out, and I thought, well, Dana would be a great guy to talk to about the guitar that you make, how you got into it, and gosh, we played Brian Sutton while we were trying to find you. I know Doc Watson played a Bourgeois guitar later in his career, and other people record with it. We can talk about that later, but let's talk about Dana Bourgeois and the guitar, how you got into manufacturing guitars.
Wow. Well, you know, it kind of goes back to, you know, first of all, I'm 61. I started playing guitar when I was in junior high school. Pretty much everyone grabbed a guitar, you know, I tell my kids that the guitar was my video game.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of people my age learned to play electric or acoustic guitar, and some small subset, I think, of that same generation sort of went on to build guitars. When I was in college, I ran into a book in a library called Classic Guitar Construction by Irving Sloan. And fascinating book, beautiful photos. As it turns out, a lot of other luthiers my age learned from that book. The method was very difficult. I wasn't that interested in classical guitars.
All right, that was the Stairwell Sisters while we were waiting to reconnect with Dana, which I believe we have successfully. He's moving around in his car looking for all the bars he can get his telephone wrapped around. You know, I think it's that whole thing about being up in Maine, maybe Stephen King, maybe this is the beginning of a new mystery novel or suspense novel from Stephen King. Let's try this again. Dana's on the phone. Hold on.
Hello.
There he is. Dana, you there?
I'm back.
You sound great now.
Magic spot.
The magic spot. Don't move. Don't move your elbow. Don't move anything.
Okay.
And just stay that way for about 45 minutes.
Where were we?
We were, here's where we were. We were talking about your early love affair with guitars, which I get that. I mean, you're close to my age, and back in the time when guitars were cool things, you wound up picking up acoustic guitars, and you read a book about making guitars, and then we were just about there when I could hear you fine, you couldn't hear me, so now we're back to that point again.
Yeah. So my grandfather was a machinist. He had a little machine shop actually out here on the island, and my dad was kind of an amateur woodworker, and I grew up around tools, and I thought, hey, you know, I'm going to give this a try. It looks like fun. I'd never had any training, and just decided to build a guitar. And it turned out, I still have it, it was playable, you know. I was more interested in steel string guitars than classical guitars, but hey, you know, I really enjoyed it. What I found, after I graduated from college, I worked for an art museum for a while, and I realized I was going to go to graduate school in museum science. I wanted to be a conservator. And I just had this epiphany one day that I really liked musicians better than art world folks. So, on the side, there were no other luthiers around. You know, I did a lot of repair work, and I always just kept building another guitar. Moved on to steel string guitars. I'd build a guitar, had a little repair shop in my apartment. You know, I'll get to know musicians. Musicians would come up to get their guitars fixed or whatever. I'd occasionally sell a guitar off the wall. And I just realized I really like doing this, you know. So, and those were the days when, you know, you could, an apartment was like $200 a month, and you could get $75 for a fret job or something.
Oh, yeah.
And there was no competition. You could do mediocre work and survive for 10 years, you know? Because, you know, this is like the early 70s.
Thinking back to that time, there were huge, huge guitar manufacturers, names that we all recognize. And then there were guys like you who were sort of coming up. And people look back on this age now and they think of it being kind of a new golden age for luthiers. And you're sort of part of that movement where, you know, you fell in love with the idea of making them and began making them in that smaller scale, like you said, in your apartment. And all of a sudden, there's all these great, great new guitars, and yours is certainly one of them. But we all know the names that existed then, so you're sort of like, you were sort of that new breed. I do think this is the era of all these great instruments being made all over the country.
Well, and, you know, the other thing is all those great names were making the worst guitars in their entire career.
You're right.
Quality-wise. And all of these musicians who started playing in the 60s were looking, some of them were looking for better guitars. Not that necessarily I and my generation were providing it then, but at least there was some interest. And, you know, later on I got involved. You know, there was no internet. There were no guitar schools. There was no way to learn other than you just make your guitar hanging on the wall. Later on, I joined the Guild of American Luthiers and went to a couple of conventions and started meeting some other makers, and we sort of became friends for life. You know, trading information, how to, and whatever. We still get together and talk shop. You know, this is like 40 years later.
Well, yeah, and that's the only way you could. That was your social network, was actually physical network and contact with other people who were doing the same type of thing.
Yeah. And nowadays, you know, there are a few guitar schools out there that you know, the Red Wing School, part of the University of Minnesota. You can get a 2-year, you know, vocational degree in guitar making. Brian Gallup has a school out in Michigan. Roberto Venn, I hire people from these programs, and they come in with a lot of skill. But the difference is they can't, it's very hard for them to make a living hanging out a shingle. They have to compete with me, for example.
Oh, you're
so
right.
Because, you know, there are quite a few. I mean, if you look at the back pages of any guitar magazine, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of, you know, single man guitar shops and putting out very good guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
There's a whole bunch of, you know, medium-sized shops like mine. That are, so there's a lot of competition for a new guy. I came along at just the right time.
Well, I was going to say, it almost sounds like you did right at the time when the big names that we know of were sort of becoming, you know, not so careful in the product they put out, and you gave an alternative. You and other luthiers gave alternatives. Well, now that maybe that opportunity is passed over for a while, but like you said, I consider you to be established in the market that you're looking for, and you're right. Somebody coming out of one of those schools, they have skills and whatnot, but they maybe don't have the opportunity because of economic issues to even try to attempt what you did in the 70s.
Yeah. So I feel blessed.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you got to...
Well, if you had a ready market of guitar players.
Right.
Now they're all living in better neighborhoods.
Well, what? So you got exposed to the construction end by reading this book about classical guitars, which are made totally different. I mean, there's different bracing, there's different neck issues, there's all kinds of. But you really got into the acoustic guitar, and at some point, you must have developed your own concepts about, you know, why you're going to be different than the other guitars, or what you're going to do. How do you come to grips with that? Just experimentation?
Well, part of it was I got involved with doing repair work, and I got to take a lot of guitars apart. And, you know, back in the early 80s, I started working for the Music Emporium in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Quite a music scene down there. You know, you could walk into the Music Emporium, and there'd be like 30 pre-war Martins hanging on the wall.
Jeez.
And, you know, and they were a little better. I mean, you know, they were revered, but they didn't have quite the value they do now, and that was kind of my graduate school, really. You know, I just got to study a lot of guitar construction. So as I did that, I learned things, played guitars that I loved the sound of, tried to emulate, you know, Martin Van Gibson mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And then my building kept evolving. Each guitar that I built kept changing a little bit. And at the time, Eric Schoenberg, one of the partners at the Music Emporium, was a big orchestra model, Martin OM enthusiast. And he collected, you know, he bought every pre-war OM that came up on the market, the national market. And a lot of them ended up in my shop because they all needed repair. None of them had steel truss rods.
Oh, jeez.
So, yeah. So I started making OMs, and then Eric and I approached Martin. This is back in about 84, and actually the original idea was they had just started a custom shop, and Eric asked Martin if they wouldn't make a custom OM for the Music Emporium that was more along the lines of, you know, the way they used to build the guitars. The old construction, and mm-hmm. they said, you know, and Dana can tell you how to do it. it's just maybe a little bit, I don't know. Anyhow, so the answer was, well, if we did that, we wouldn't put our name on it.
Oh, okay.
So I said, well, how about if you put my name on it? So what eventually came of that was that we made an OM style guitar with a cutaway under the name Schoenberg Guitars, and I was involved in the design and the wood selection, and I made some of the parts, like the pyramid bridges. So we made several hundred of these guitars and sold them.
Wow.
Eric and I had a guitar company. And so that was a further, you know, that was like a big step. That kind of got me into the national market. And I, you know, it would have been difficult. Turn it around the other way. It would have been easier for me to have a career for maybe anywhere but Maine. But you know, somehow it managed to happen. Along the way, we got to know Tony Rice,
who was
in the 80s was working out of Boston quite a bit. His management was in Boston. He played a lot around in the Northeast. And, you know, I kept showing him dreadnoughts. And, you know, Tony was always polite. And he'd say, I remember him once saying, well, this guitar doesn't make it, man.
He was just giving me honest feedback.
Sure.
And then he spent a lot of time and tried to explain what he liked and let me be very generous in letting me play his guitar. And he'd play the guitars back and forth, side by side, and I'd have to admit, yeah, he's right, it doesn't make it. So,
what a great sounding board. What a great sounding board to have Tony Rice, helping you retune your manufacturing process, too.
Oh, yeah. So one day we brought along, I brought along an OM, and he played it, and he said, this is it, man. This is the sound you're after. You know? He said, you just have to put it in a dreadnought package, a bigger package.
Hmm.
So what he was looking for was the balance of an OM. Good note-to-note. You know, string to string, note to note balance. Then they kind of realized that, you know, yeah, this dreadnought, a lot of them are very bottom heavy, but bluegrass guitar players were not just playing V runs and 5 capo positions anymore.
No, well, he sort of changed that for everybody.
He sure did, you know, and then Doc Watson and Clarence White even before him.
Mm-hmm.
But the point was, he needed every note on the fretboard. And so then I started to think, wow, you know, that's a whole new idea. It took me 10 years or so. I had to change a bunch of things to get that to happen. I had to change a lot of things, actually. And then Tony kind of dropped out of the scene for quite a while, and I lost contact with him. I'd left Schoenberg Guitars, started Bourgeois Guitars, And one day, a young Brian Sutton walked into George Gruen Guitars, and Brian had just gotten hired by Ricky Skaggs.
Mm.
He was playing an old J45, which didn't have enough power, you know, to front a big bluegrass band. He was looking for the best sounding guitar within his budget. I guess he had a budget, so he wasn't looking at vintage stuff then. Played all the guitars on the wall, and he came across one of mine and really liked it, bought it, and as it turns out, I sort of achieved that sound that, you know, Tony had had inspired me to achieve. Brian came along and, you know, sort of took it and ran with it for a while, and he really started his career, his first couple of albums with Tony, and his first couple of solo albums were done entirely on using Bourgeois guitars. And after that, my career was fairly well established.
Well, so, and for the listeners, we're talking to Dana Bourgeois. We had some connection problems earlier, but we're talking about guitars. And you mentioned Gruen Guitar. That's a place in Nashville where serious musicians, acoustic musicians, can go find all kinds of great instruments. So as you're developing this sound from the input you got back from Tony Rice, you kind of get to where you think Tony would have been happy, and then Brian Sutton picks up one of your guitars off of the wall at Gruen as a shortcut version of what you said, right?
Yep.
And, of course, Brian is as everybody is, after Tony started playing, everybody's a fan of Tony's playing, so that kind of made perfect sense, and he's been off to the races playing your guitars very, very well, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the more recent recordings you hear from Brian, who's playing, you know, vintage Martin guitars.
Mm-hmm.
He's also living in better neighborhoods, and he's kind of branched out. He came back in his smaller venues, at any rate. Last fall, he did a tour with sort of a bunch of bluegrass all-stars, and he's been doing some duet performances with Courtney Hartman, and he's been using his old Bourgeois guitars for that.
Well, and that was when I saw him in the fall, because was that with Gnome and
yeah
okay, that's when I saw him last. Okay, so he had it then. Yeah,
he was using a Brazilian a Bourgeois Brazilian dreadnought for that tour.
Yeah, okay.
So we're in the process. A few years ago, I did a reissue of one of his guitars. You probably heard about, you may have heard about the Banjo Killer.
Oh, yes.
The first Bourgeois guitar that he bought, he dubbed the Banjo Killer because it was so loud. And I played that one for quite a while, and then I built him
That was a mahogany slope shoulder dreadnought. And then I built him a Brazilian dreadnought, which he had. So he's had those two guitars for about 18 years now.
Mm, wow.
It's really kind of cool because I'm comparing my new guitars to really nicely broken in, guitars that he's been playing for that long. We did a reissue of the Banjo Killer, I think, in 2004. And we're going to be, we're working on a reissue of his D-150. His
okay.
Brazilian dreadnought.
Okay.
Which may, depending on, well, so Brian likes the prototype. The idea is I have a new process, which is making guitars sound a little older and more broken in out of the box. And I think I've got some guitars that sound the way Brian wants to hear them. And we're working on the packaging, and hopefully we'll have a reissue of his D-150.
Oh, that's good.
Before the year is out. Yeah.
Well, Dana, we could talk forever about different woods. I could ask questions about different woods and their impact and different all the modifications you can make. But let me ask you this. Do you notice a difference between a guitar that Brian had for 18 years as it's been seasoned, so to speak, versus what you remember it sounding like then? Is there a real difference to your ear?
Well, I think a couple of things happen. One of the reasons why these older guitars, pre-war guitars, are so well revered is that they change over time. There's a chemical transformation that happens just with, decades of seasoning of the wood and of the finish. And then, of course, there's the effect of being played. A guitar gets used to vibrating. So, if the guitar is still in structurally good condition and it's been played for a long time, it's just impossible to make a brand new guitar that sounds exactly the same way. I've been trying to do that. I've been working on a process now called torrefaction, in which we're cooking the wood in an oxygen-free environment, almost like making charcoal, just partly cooking it. If you're actually cooking off a lot of the volatiles, essentially the creosote in the wood. And these are organic materials, pitch, resins, oils, sugars, that kind of thing, which will oxidize away over many decades of air drying. So we've been trying to, accelerate that chemical process.
You're trying to artificially age it.
Artificially age the wood before building the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes a difference. I mean, the wood, after processing the wood, it becomes stiffer and lighter and more responsive.
Okay.
I've been playing around with finishes. A lacquer finish will lose about half of its weight over 50 years of curing. Lacquer is kind of like, concrete never finishes curing. It just keeps shrinking and shrinking and getting harder and harder. And when the finish gets harder and lighter, it just helps the wood vibrate more as opposed to damping wood.
Okay.
So I've been working on those kinds of things. With some luck, I've had some success. I had this great session with Brian in December. I was down in Nashville, and I brought two of my new treated guitars. And then he brought two 18-year-old guitars that I built for him way back when. And then he brought two vintage guitars, pre-war Martin and a Gibson. So we had a Martin and a Gibson style of each model. And he just, I was like, it was in heaven,
mm-hmm.
Just listening to him play all of the guitars and comment on them. Brian's very articulate about what he's hearing. And I went away learning, hearing a lot more, and I made some modifications to the new guitars that I was building, and showed him a prototype about a month ago, that one was the one that he really liked. So it's been a great relationship over this time. I mean, I've worked a lot with players. I'm sort of like if I were driving a Ferrari or something, which I don't,
I wouldn't be able to understand its maximum performance capabilities because I'm not an experienced driver. By the same token, I'm not, you know, I mean, I can play guitar, but I can't play at the highest level. So I really rely on players. I've always brought guitars to players and said, here, what do you think? And sometimes you get your butt kicked like I did with Tony. And like I say, he wasn't mean about it, but he basically delivered some bad news.
But you need that input.
Exactly. You've got to be willing to go back and get your butt kicked again. So I've always done that. To me, it's all about the playing. I mean, I don't do... You know, I make some fancy guitars, and I kind of like that, but I don't do, you know, inlaid mermaids and dragons with six strings attached. I mean, to me, it's all about building guitars that real players want to make real music
on. You just lost the entire Lord of the Rings crowd, by the way.
Well, you know, there's other guitars for them. That's a wonderful thing. I mean, there's such variety out there. You know, you've got to kind of pick what it is you want to hone in on. People ask me, you know, gee, you should make mandolins, man. There's a great market for high-end mandolins. You know, wouldn't that be... I'd really love to get a bourgeois mandolin. And my, you know, my reaction is, I don't have another lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm still trying to get guitars right.
Well, I was going to mention that, too. You're still, after all these years of that first guitar and that first classic guitar book on how you're still learning and modifying, improving everything as you go through.
Yeah, that's what keeps me going to work every day. I mean, mm-hmm. I could retire now, but I still enjoy the music. I enjoy the challenge. I enjoy the relationship with the players. You know, I guess in some way I'm a frustrated player myself, so this is my way of contributing to the music.
Oh boy, are you ever.
That I love so much.
I've heard a lot of them on stage and recordings, and you know, I think of where am I going to branch out on this particular program, and I'm always looking for new, and I thought, well, I don't know what I saw, but I thought I could talk to Dana, because I've seen the guitars often enough, and I figure you're you know, articulate, smart guy, and that you have a nice approach to this, and I thought... And, you know, and honestly, Dana, we could talk about all the intricacies, and we talked a little bit about the finish. We haven't even touched on the type of wood, the thickness of the wood, the preparation, just a little bit in that kind of accelerated aging thing that you do. But we haven't gotten into bridges. We haven't gotten into neck. We haven't gotten into bracing inside the body of the guitar. There's so many things that you have to consider when you get that feedback. What do you tweak to make that sound the way that artist like Brian is trying to tell you that it needs?
Well, part of it is starts with the wood selection. You know, you try to... I mean, I feel fortunate. Well, first of all, the world supply of, you know, mature tone wood keeps dwindling every year. But I'm sort of living... You know, my reputation is such that I get offered stuff that other people don't get offered. And I have relationships with suppliers that go back, you know, for decades.
Yeah.
Guys who know what I like, and so I've been fortunate in that sense that I can still get my hands on good stuff. And then after that, I treat no two pieces of wood are alike, so they all end up different thicknesses, and I try to tap and flex, and the whole idea is to shape the braces and shape the tops of the backs to bring out the greatest variety of different tones that I can in that given piece of wood. So that's part of it also. I have a small shop. We make about 400 guitars a year, and there are about, you know, 10 guys in production. And this part of voicing, it's called, is done by several different people, including myself. And we kind of get to have the benefit of of taking a team approach, a committee approach, so to speak, correcting each other. The whole idea is to try to get this brace top and back to sound as good as that piece of wood can sound before we glue it up into a guitar body.
Mm.
And so we get the benefit of a lot of different people's feedback. It's got to be built within a certain stiffness. And that's a combination of the stiffness of the wood and of the braces, and no two are alike. So you have to make adjustments to them. But with enough experience, you can tell, you know, it actually, the process actually happens fairly quickly. But that's because between the team, we bring a lot of experience to bear when we're working on it on an individual guitar.
Well, and you know, when Dana said tap and flex, you're actually tapping and flex. It's that hands on, because each piece of wood is different, and it's all that knowledge and experience that you have that allows you to put all those components together for each piece of wood and each type of guitar and make it sound that sound that you're chasing in your head. It's just from all that experience and time that you've put into it. Just it's a great process. We could talk for days about, and I wouldn't want you to give away any secrets or anything, but it's a labor of love, constantly looking for that sound that when you get that look back from like a Brian Sutton, you know you've hit the right thing that they're looking for, and that's what you have to constantly be available to make adjustments to make it work.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's new stuff all the time. You know, there are new tone woods coming on the market. There's all kinds of new things that can be tried.
All the resin guitars, all the guitars that come out with new materials for the bodies that work or don't work, but you have to react to the sounds that could come off of those new, synthetic, I guess, guitars.
Back in the old days, I mean, Mark and Gibson used Brazilian rosewood in the back and sides, and used red spruce for tops, and that was it. Well, it's really hard to get Brazilian rosewood now, and the kind that you get is from a different part of the tree. Brazilian rosewood is on the endangered species list, and so they can't cut new trees.
They're harvesting
old stumps. So, you know, there are other species of tropical hardwoods are coming onto the market, and somehow some of them sound a little bit like, you know, the old Brazilian rosewood, but you have to work with them a little bit differently. So, you know, we've experimented with that. I was one of the first to use Madagascar rosewood in any kind of large quantity, and now it's kind of become a standard, you know, for the high-end market, standard, you know, substitution for Brazilian.
Okay.
And now it's getting hard to get. I guess what I want to say is it's a moving target.
Well, yeah, Dana Bourgeois, you never get to go to work thinking I've got it figured out, now I just got to keep doing this, because everything changes every day as the market changes.
I never say I've got it nailed and all I have to do is just stamp them out.
That's right. That's the point I'm trying to make. You make it so much better. Yeah, that's exactly right. An amazing process that you go through, and just I want people to know what Bourgeois Guitars and what Dana Bourgeois goes through, and you've done a good job of explaining that, you know, without having a class or someone tour your factory as to what happens, and it's such a massive undertaking. And that's why the guitars sound so good, and why the really, you know, really good players love them and play them and record with them. It's what we've capsulized in, I don't know, between our different disconnects, 30, 35 minutes. I hope people have gotten a vision of what exactly is involved in manufacturing a guitar. And I think they have.
Good.
All right. Dana, listen, I know you're on only vacation, and I appreciate you putting up with our phone problems early, and we'll do this again sometime, and we'll do part two, and we'll take it into the next level of no trade secrets, but just we'll get into some more detail about what you're doing. But I appreciate you taking the time and going out in a car in the rainstorm and hooking up with Unreal Bluegrass. It's been a blast. I hope you liked it.
Okay, yeah, and before we go, you mentioned something. We do factory tours if you're ever up in Lewiston, Maine.
Oh, yeah.
Usually on Fridays, but give us a call and schedule a tour and come by and see us.
Okay, all right. We'll do that. Dana Bourgeois, thanks so much for making great guitars and taking the time off of your vacation time to try to help us understand, look through the glass outside a little bit to see what goes on inside that process. There's a lot going on, a lot of love, a lot of attention, and you deserve all the credit that you get for making fine guitars.
Great. Thank you, Steve. I really enjoyed it.
All right, Dana. I'll talk to you later, man. All right, thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
There you go. There's Dana Bourgeois. It took him a while, but we finally hooked up. Sometimes we can't control the phone connections, but once we finally got it going, that was fun. What an amazing process, building a guitar. Who knew it would be that difficult?